I want to welcome you to the House Committee on Judiciary this afternoon. We're 10 minutes late, which by this committee's post-lunch standards is actually about 4 minutes ahead of our average. So we appreciate your patience with us. We are going to change the agenda just briefly to accommodate some travel schedules. So committee, if you'll follow along, we're going to go to House Bill 3559. I'll open a public hearing, invite Steve Dole from Crime Victims United and Judge Galton to come forward. And I know you're waiting still, Steve, from somebody from the Attorney General's office. Okay. All right. All right, then we'll recess the hearing on House Bill 3559, and we'll wait until the Attorney General has arrived. Just pause 1 minute here while we figure out our order of business.
No.
Let me open a hearing on House Bill 2414, which is the first bill on the agenda. Do we have sign-ups for that bill? Okay. All right. That's all. Okay. Bert Geiger and Denny Kelly, if you two would come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Bert Geiger. I represent the Oregon Association of Reserve Peace Officers, which is a subchapter of the Oregon Association of Peace Officers, and also I'm the commander of the Portland Police Reserves and have served as a sworn officer for Portland for 15 years. I'm here to ask for the passage in favor of House Bill 2414. As was titled in your summary here, this does not expand the authority of police reserve officers. It merely clarifies some of the definitions here. Reserve officers represent most of the major are represented in most of the major cities of Oregon and sheriff's departments, and in some small agencies, if it wasn't for reserve officers, they'd have a hard time performing their functions. In Portland alone, we have over the years and some years contributed over 125,000 hours to the city of Portland for voluntary police services. Certainly in these high security times, the assets of volunteer reserve peace officers, police officers, is very important. We've served during September 11th at the airport, helping out security there, and certainly, and we work routinely with daily with the Portland Police Bureau, and during these times of protest and civil disobedience, we've been there every time. The passage of this bill is important to allow reserve officers to have the authority which they basically already have been granted by their local jurisdictions. We just need some clarification. We will and can provide some written testimony for you to clarify some of the finer points. Officer Kelly is here to talk specifically about some of the clarifications in the bill.
Okay. Officer Kelly.
I am Denny Kelly with the Portland Police Bureau. I represent the City of Portland and the Portland Police Bureau in this endeavor. I command or actually coordinate the reserve program for the City of Portland, which numbers about 41 members total, and 30 of them are sworn. First of all, I'd like to point out that I believe the intent of 133005, which is in front of us today, and additionally one that is not listed on here, but 133525, is meant to define the basic functions of law enforcement, powers of arrest, cite in lieu of custody, uniform traffic citations, and community caretaking. And I think it was legislative intent that that reserve officers were part of the law enforcement community and be allowed to and expected to do some of these functions. This bill, like Commander Geiger mentioned, is really a clarification of the authority of these guidelines for law enforcement. Again, the intent is, I believe, reaffirmed in some of the DPSST regulations around security officers that probably about two sessions ago was brought up and established. Clearly, reserve officers were not put in that category. And I think it's fairly clear to most people that reserve officers are part of the law enforcement community as opposed to being part of the security community. The truth is that since 1973 or whenever 133.005 originated, the reserve officers existed at that time in much the same capacity, enforcing laws, writing traffic citation, and functioning as part of law enforcement community since then. So past practice would dictate that merely adding the term reserve officer to this, both of these statutes would merely clarify their authority, which has, again, been past practice. And lastly, this is the proper venue. It's a legislative venue where we need to take care of this issue and not have volunteers in the law enforcement community who are donating their time to the protection and welfare of our communities face this issue in a court of law at possibly their own expense and their own stress that they have to deal with in that time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for either of these gentlemen? Representative Ackerman?
No, I'd like to.
Oh, okay.
Just wave my hand.
I don't see, normally on a bill like this, or I would have expected to see either the Chiefs or the Sheriff's Association. Have either of them taken a position on the bill, do you know?
I've been working with Chief Croker of Portland. We have his support on this bill. We have the support of other chiefs, and I, in further written testimony, I will give you letters of their support. The city of Portland supports this.
Okay. Anything else to add, Mr. Kelly?
Yes, Commander Benson, Commander of the TOD division of our organization. I talked to him before I came down here and got the blessing of him. They're full support of this, and he carries the authority of Assistant Chief Andrew Kirkland as well.
Okay. Any other questions for these gentlemen? Representative Barker.
Officer Kelly, this just brings reserve officer in where you believe they've been intended to be for some time, in it so that they can actually perform the job they're already performing. But this just clears that up.
Correct. A good example is we have a reserve officer that works a school zone as part of traffic division, volunteers his time to come out and any tickets, people speeding through school zones and children are present. And we just feel that if without this, the authority is not clear by this. And we want that clarified until before somebody ends up taking an officer like that to court, trying to do the right thing. But
Your officers are BPSST certified. Your reserve officers?
As I know, there are no BPSST-certified reserve officers.
Okay.
I understand that there has been a creation of that category, but I'd also like to point out that certified reserve officers are also not covered by this.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'm just curious as to what authority have they been operating, because I know in the cities that I serve as prosecutors, we've got reserve officers out there and they've been out there for years.
That's my point about past practice. We have been doing that, and actually probably when this bill took effect, they were probably out there working in that capacity. There is no specific statute that we can find that gives designated reserve officer, by definition, of powers to arrest or any of that. In the statute and some of the other statutes that define peace officer and police officer, it refers to things like constable, marshal, municipal police officer. We would just like it to say reserve officer because that's the common language that is used around this state.
Anything further? Who else had their hand up? Representative Crummell, you were tentative about a question?
I was, but I think it's been answered.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
All right. Counsel?
Chairman of the Committee, Mr. Kelly, another one. When I did a word search of the statute, I saw the term reserve officer, but more often than not, I saw the term certified reserve officer. What's the difference?
The certified reserve officer definition came out a couple of years ago by the legislature under the DPSST statutes that gave, I believe, DPSST the authority to certify reserve officers. My understanding is that they have never designed a program that certification program for reserve officers, I've never seen the guidelines for that.
Nor did the legislature at that time provide funding to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen, you're okay. Wave off. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, Mr. DeLashman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLash, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Let me actually start. You've known me for a long time, and I'm relatively direct on my arguments and so forth. I'll give you kind of a heads up here. I'm in an area that I'm not totally familiar with here, so what I'm going to attempt to do is portray the client's opposition to this bill and what they've indicated to me, and then if there is an opportunity, obviously, to have a discussion with the proponents of this bill and with my client, and some of those issues can either be resolved, clarified, we may step aside. But I think you actually hit in your line of discussion on at least one of the concerns that the client, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, have is the distinction between certified reserve officer and reserve officers, and the level of training. And what you're doing is expanding the authority, and I've heard the proponents say to clarify exactly what they think they already should or could be able to do. But my client relayed to me that this, in fact, they believe it's an expansion of authority to, in fact, do arrests. That concerned them somewhat, but the ability to carry a concealed handgun concerned them more. And without the ability to have a certified reserve officer going through DPSST training, to get that training they need in the handguns, they had some concern in that area. And with that, I'll end my comments and answer any questions. Again, I have a limited knowledge base in this.
Representative Jensen.
Just a question here for the people. A reserve officer is in a generic term here, not distinguishing between certified or otherwise. However, there'd be nothing in the ORSs that would present an uncertified, in your thing, a police officer, a reserve officer, from carrying a sidearm as long as it wasn't concealed. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, you're in again in an area that I'm not familiar with.
I think any citizen, barring some exceptions, is entitled to carry a handgun as long as it's not concealed.
I believe you're correct.
Yeah.
Except in Portland.
Well, except under some...
City ordinances.
Yeah, city or other ordinances. Federal building, probably.
Further questions for Mr. DeLashman? Okay.
I appreciate you.
Being kind to you?
Being kind to
me. That's all right.
In that case, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but Brian, here's what I'd like you to do, if you would, because it does sound like what they're shooting for is to get the same sort of coverage that under the statute that they think they used to be entitled to and that they're operating in their jurisdictions as if they have. And so I would like you to do what you indicated, which is to, you know, sort of run the trap line back with your clients about the concerns of the bill, work with these two gentlemen and the folks at the Portland Police Bureau, and then I'd like to encourage the Portland Police Bureau people to have a conversation with the chiefs and the Sheriff's Association, because I'd like to know where they stand vis-a-vis the bill, in part because they typically are the voice in this committee that speaks for not just one division or one department, but for the chiefs of police generally on all the departments throughout the state, and the same with the sheriff. So I'm going to ask that you at least inquire with their representatives here in the building to get a position on the bill, whether it's for, against, or neutral, and report that back to the committee. Counsel, Mr. Taylor, before we take any further action on the bill. Does that seem reasonable?
Okay.
With that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2414. We'll jump back to House Bill 3559. I've seen the arrival of the Attorney General, and we're pleased to have him here, so I'll reopen the hearing on House Bill 3559 and ask Judge Galton, the Attorney General, Mr. Dole, to come forward. Welcome, and Mr. Dole, do you want to lead off?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I have here with me today the Attorney General of the State of Oregon, Harding Myers, and my friend. It may surprise some of you to know that I have judges that are friends. My friend, Judge Sid Galton from Multnomah County. And I have even more than Judge Galton, believe it or not. We are here today to...
Representative Shaler is demanding a list of names.
I'll be happy to supply him with that list.
Sworn affidavits.
We're here to testify today to House Bill 3559 in support of. It's a short bill. It's fairly direct. It calls... for the production of radio and television advertisements regarding Measure 11, and a videotape to be made also on Measure 11. It's not to be portrayed as either for or against Measure 11. It's basically to speak to kids not to get involved in violent crime, because there's serious responsibility and accountability factors, and it's meant as an educational piece and a preventive piece. I have for a long time felt that this is the one part of our criminal justice system that's missing, and that is to educate people around the responsibility and accountability factors as far as sentencing goes for doing crimes in the state of Oregon. I think that that, for instance, Mothers Against Drunk Driving and the Oregon State Police have done a great job on this issue, on drunken driving issues, but we haven't done the same thing on the issue of violent crime. One of the things that Judge Galton will talk to you about today is a program that we've done personally in the Portland area. But there's an anecdotal story I want to relay to you about this, and then I'll turn it over to the Attorney General and to the judge. When Measure 11 first came out, we went through the Portland Public Schools and held talked to the students about Measure 11. And there was a crime committed a number of years ago in Portland involving three young men that involved at least 20-plus armed robberies around the city of Portland. And the ringleader in this was a fellow by the name of Tom Curtis, who was president of Grand High School. When this crime occurred, I talked to Mike Schrunk, and I asked Mike, who's the district attorney of Portland, if we went to Grand High School. And I think he said, God, he hoped we did. And we checked in the file, and what we found was we did go to Grand High School. But we went to the evening school because those were, quote-unquote, the at-risk kids, because we were told by the principal those are the kids we need to get to. So we never talked to the general student body. Now, I always find that fascinating because, of course, three of the kids who were involved were in the general student body, one of those being the president of the student body. And those were first-degree armed robberies. But I think this is a... I think this is a worthwhile project. I would leave it at this. I don't think any of us in our homes would set rules for our children and hide them in a drawer and not tell the kids about what the consequences may be. We let them know up front so they know what they're facing if they act out or act up. And I think that's what we've got to do with this bill and Measure 11. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Dole. Mr. Myers?
Thank you, Chair Williams. Members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I was very pleased to join Crime Victims United as a co-requester of this bill because with Steve, I think there is real potential benefit in widening the awareness of Oregon's young people about the potential severity of our state's response to certain kinds of offenses. I certainly don't think I see any downside to making Oregonians aware of that, and I think that it could be done, as this bill proposes, at a relatively nominal investment in the form of public service announcements as well as films available to schools. And, of course, explicitly, by my being here and having joined as a co-requester of the bill, I'd be very pleased to be assigned the responsibility by the legislature to develop and assure the dissemination of these materials. Obviously, to state the obvious, if this measure were to become law, I would expect to involve an appropriate mix of professionals and others in actually developing the content of the measures. But nonetheless, to sum up, I think it would be a, for a small investment, a good element of a prevention strategy in Oregon, and I'd be very pleased to be assigned the responsibility that's described in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Your Honor, welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm one of 168 circuit judges, and I'm appearing for myself. However, I do have the permission of my presiding judge and the knowledge and authorization of the Oregon Judicial Department. My interest in this area stemmed from my sadness and incredulity at having pretty early on in this judicial position the obligation to sentence 15, 16, 17-year-old kids to 70 and 90 months, and looking at the carnage around the courtroom of the victim's family, and the defendant and the defendant's family. And so with four other people, we created what we call a school presentation project. The representative of crime victims is Steve Dole. Lieutenant Modica of the Portland Police is from the police. Terry Mayo, who's a deputy district attorney, represents the prosecutors. Yolanda Watkins, a criminal defense attorney, represents those folks. And I am the judge, and we've gone out to initially at-risk kids, albeit during the regular school hours, at Cleveland High School, where I attended, and then to two social studies classes at Central Catholic. And as our schedules permit, the five of us, and as schools allow us, we give the same message, which is we don't want the kids to make stupid decisions that destroy their lives, their families' lives, victims, and victims' families' lives. The rationale behind our little project is that if we save one student from perpetrating a crime and save one Multnomah County resident from becoming a victim, our time is well spent. I know you don't have any money. And I know that the judiciary would certainly be thrilled to have any funds, but this is a small amount to do something that we're doing individually. And, in fact, Steve and I talked about videotaping what we were doing, and we may still do that, and make those available to schools. But on behalf of myself and our little group, and I think I speak for the trial judges, anything that can be done, especially with a small investment, to keep people out of the criminal justice system and to keep people from being victimized is a good thing, and I therefore enthusiastically support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judge Galton. Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an excellent program that the three of you have brought forward. My concern with only the $75,000 that we've maximized it the best we can, I would assume that that's going to cover the production cost. And it seems like one of the things we want to be able to do is have extra tapes to give out to the different schools. Is it contemplated that besides trying to buy time for advertisement, using this as a PSA and trying to disseminate it throughout the state, so that way we can maybe save our cost for the production, knowing that if we start buying broadcast time, we're going to use that money up very quickly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, there are some proposed amendments you'll see to House Bill 3559. that are dated 3/20/03. You should have those. If you don't, we'll provide them to you. You can see that the intent, in fact, is for production purposes and dissemination as PSAs. We don't have any intention of that, because that would be just cost prohibitive. In fact, our intention was if the money that would be appropriated for this, if it is appropriated, if it isn't enough, we'll have to go out and get a grant. If we've got leftover, you can take it back into the general fund. But one way or another, I think the way I look at this is that this $75,000 you'll save five times over by keeping one person out of a 70-month sentence at the state prison, and that's a way to really look at this financially. And so it's more than paid for itself if it just stops one person from committing a crime.
Chair Williams, Representative Sanchez, could I add just quickly, it would be my hope if this bill became law that some amount of the professional consultation that would be involved in actually developing the messages might well turn out to be donated time. Certainly we'd seek to accomplish that.
Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I just have a quick question on Section 1, B, and C, lines 7 and 9, appear to me to be somewhat redundant. Can you help me understand the difference between a juvenile and someone who's 12 to 18 years old?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's another a mistake that's been made in this bill in drafting that we didn't catch. We thought we caught these with the amendments. What we were trying to do is produce two television ads and two radio ads. One of the television ads would be directed at the general public to instruct, and one of the radio ads to instruct all, to including to get to adults and or parents, obviously. The other one would be directed strictly at the juvenile, so that is a
mistake. It may not be a mistake because this is a videotape.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I see what it is now. The videotape is different from the advertisements. The advertisements are directed. I'm sorry. I'm not reading this correctly. The advertisements are for the PSAs. The videotape is something that would be like a 20-minute tape that would be distributed to the junior high schools and high schools for individuals between 12 and 18 years. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's have Susan Russell from OCDLA come on up.
Good afternoon. Susan Russell from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here just briefly to also speak in favor of this bill. In the last 8 years since Measure 11 has gone into effect, I've had a number of opportunities to participate in what are called street law high school classes, where we speak informally and have a free exchange with students. I'm aware firsthand through to speaking with students in terms of the real lack of understanding of some of the implications and the expansiveness of Measure 11. In speaking and meeting with these kids, it makes a huge impression when they talk and understand the number of circumstances in which Measure 11 applies and could potentially affect their conduct. I think their knowledge, having this knowledge is extremely important in terms of deterring their conduct. It's particularly important in dealing with this age group when we're talking about issues such as robbery and assault, in particular when kids get swept into a bad plan that becomes a criminal plan and they're charged by an aid and assist type theory. A lot of times kids get pulled into that kind of behavior thinking it's no big deal. They're not the leader. They're just sort of following. It is a big deal. It's a Measure 11 deal. And I believe that programs such as the one anticipated and proposed by House Bill 3559 may help tremendously in terms of giving the kids the information they need to deter and to change their behavior and to prevent them from being involved in such type of conduct. On behalf of the OCDLA, we are more than happy to share experience and expertise we have in meeting with kids and in terms of the juvenile caseload that we've handled in preparing any programs or broadcasts that may originate from this bill.
Great. Thank you. Susan, are there questions for Susan? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3559? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. We'll open a work session. Colleagues, we have a Dash 1 amendment that was referenced initially to the bill, and this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Patridge is one of the sponsors of this bill, and he and I have discussed it, and my indication was if the committee found the bill ready to go, that we would ship it out down to the Ways and Means Committee, where he would attempt to factor it into their other approaches on the budget. So, Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 1s in the House Bill 3559.
Representative Przanski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3559. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection. The amendments are adopted. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3559 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 3559 as amended to the floor with subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Is there discussion on that motion?
To the floor first and then to Ways
and Means? Well, the real motion, Representative Kimmel, is to the floor with subsequent referral to Ways and Means is how that's structured in the actual language of the motion.
But does it?
But it goes to Ways and Means.
First.
Technically, it goes to the floor and then goes to Ways and Means without us ever having to do anything to it. So it really means it's going to Ways and Means.
Thank you for the clarification.
You're very welcome, Representative Kimmel. Okay, hearing nothing, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I merely would like to encourage the Attorney General and sponsors of this to perhaps seek some high-profile performers to help put these ads together. I think this is a type of public service that maybe some of the high-profile individuals in our society, in our country, would be delighted to participate in, and they might have a better appeal to some junior high school kids than
seems like we got a lot of trailblazers with experience.
I was not thinking about that particular group of performers.
Good
but,
line
you know.
Up there.
They just think they're amusing.
All right. Nancy, do you want to call the roll?
Ackerman?
Aye.
Arthur?
Aye.
Manson?
Aye.
Cromwell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Monsey?
Aye.
Chair
Hurley?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3559, as amended, will go to the Ways and Means Committee. So we don't need to assign a carrier. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2802. Council, you want to bring us up to speed on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from a work group during the interim session that Craig Prince was actively involved in, and redefines the crime of arson in the first degree. And it sets forth in the staff measure summary what the elements are. And part of the bill is designed to address the Ray DeFord case. Where the issue was arson and the fact that it was a piece of paper lit, and the question was it was a property of value.
Okay. We have a panel, and we'll ask you to pull up a fourth chair. Ken Armstrong, Tim Burr, Cortland Geyer, and Bob Livingston. And I don't know if I got your last name right, Cortland, reading and writing here. And obviously some of you who've watched local news, you're familiar with Mr. Burr, who is from the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and is often the public spokesman. And I've heard him speak on several occasions, and I love the fact that his name is Tim Burr. And I know you get teased about it all the time, but I can't help bringing it up because it's so darn funny.
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I can only hope that somebody will get a chance to meet my brother, Lum.
After years of experience, you prepared that as a redemption. That's perfect.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Przanski.
We also need to give acknowledgement that Tim actually served in the Eugene Fire Department as their spokesperson, too, so we've had an opportunity to watch him actually on the ice as well, taking care of a little business out at the ice rink.
All right. We're ready. Ken, you want to walk us through this?
Be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and also the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. House Bill 2802 comes to you really as a result of some activity last session. where this committee saw legislation brought by us that would tighten up the Arson 1 statute. And what we really have been after, as some of my colleagues here will go into a little bit more detail, is to take those folks who are, if you want to use this phrase, very good arsonists, know how to do it, they're serious about it, they know that under many circumstances, they may get away with nothing more than reckless burning or criminal mischief. Last session, we ended up making some changes to the Arson 2 statute, pledged to work with the judiciary staff and other interested parties to bring back a more detailed, not a rewrite, but some other changes to Arson 1, and that's what you have before you in House Bill 2802. We worked with the District Attorneys Association, which Mr. Geyer represents, with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, with the Fire Chiefs Association, the criminal defense attorneys, several Oregon State Police arson units. Representative of that organization is here today as well, to try and hash through all of these issues. And we made progress, I think, on many fronts. We didn't reach total agreement with all parties, of course, as you might expect, but I think what you see here, at least from the fire service standpoint, is a good work product that is going to go a long ways towards tightening up the ability of district attorneys to charge Arson 1, to protect firefighters, to protect the public and other emergency response personnel and property, of course. With that, I want to turn it over to the experts, and I will first turn to my colleague, Mr. Tim Burr.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Burr. I am a division chief with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and a member of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I'm also the current chair of the Oregon Council Against Arson. This bill, the genesis for this bill began following several events around Oregon, in particular a fire in Polk County, Oregon, several years ago, which came very close to taking the lives of a number of volunteer firefighters. Legally, while the law has always provide a lot of protection for citizens from fire-setting behavior, firefighters oftentimes have been considered to accept the challenges and the risks that come from fire pretty much being on their own. And one of the things that that has become a growing issue is the concern of firefighter safety, the concern of trying to protect firefighters a little bit more. What this law does specifically is, through our deliberations, we identified three behaviors: the use of incendiary devices, the practice of using multiple sets or multiple points of origin for a fire, and modifications to a structure that would either enhance the spread of fire, potentially entrap firefighters in some way, make things move along further. Those three behaviors have two things in common. Each of them represents a degree of premeditation and planning that differentiates them from the spur of the moment crime of passion that occasionally results in a case of arson. The other thing is, all three of those behaviors have the things that have the potential to injure and kill firefighters. I've been in the fire service for 28 years. I spent 10 of those years actually working in a firehouse. I've been in a number of arson fires. I've been in fires involving those kinds of fire-setting behaviors. And those are the things that pose the greatest danger. An incendiary device that fails to go off initially may go off while firefighters are on scene working in or around a building. Multiple sets always present a hazard. You arrive on scene, you think you're fighting a fire in the attic, and then you realize that there's also a fire burning below you in the basement. And obviously, modification of a structure can also create some severe hazards, especially about holes in floors and those kinds of things. So for those reasons, on behalf of my agency, on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, we're very supportive of this bill.
Thank you, Tim.
Good afternoon. My name is Cortland Geyer. I'm with the Marion County District Attorney's Office. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am also a member of the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and I want to convey that ODAA is familiar with the bill and supports it. What I want to bring to light to you is that the situations that we are talking here, if there are budget considerations, or if you're thinking, what is the impact on the criminal caseload, what we are talking about is a very, very small number of very, very serious cases that right now I submit to you there are insufficient consequences to punish or to, more importantly, deter new criminal conduct.
like to give you an example, several examples of this. Hypothetical examples, though they may be similar to the case that Mr. Burr mentioned. And before I do this, I want to give it a qualification. I don't mean to be pointing the finger at anyone with these examples. They reflect current shortcomings in the current law, and also particularly right now, some current budgetary matters, both of long-standing and then more recent vintage. So let's say, in my example, that you have a remote, unoccupied factory. There is a nighttime fire. There is no one in it. It's not customarily occupied at that time. And it burns to the ground. For your million-dollar factory loss, the most serious crime that we can charge under current law is arson in the second degree. What is the presumptive sentence for that under sentencing guidelines? The presumptive sentence is probation in most cases. Now, today, given budgetary crises that have budgetary shortcomings that have been longer than the ones that have gotten current news, most county jails, in at least the major counties, have severe overcrowding. For arson two, that person is likely to not get any jail time, to not serve any substantial jail time. And then I want to point out also that if this were to occur today, the case would not be processed by the court until July. Arson 2's not being processed by the court right now. Let's add to that a couple of other things brought up by the bill. Let's say the arsonist used a dangerous incendiary device, the instructions for which are available on the Internet for anyone to find. It would still be an arson, too. Let's say they set several of them at different points of the building. We are still talking an arson, too, even if they put a hole in the building to somehow enhance the spread of the fire. The other thing that I want to make sure the committee knows before I leave, the question I get most often on this is, does this create new ballot measure 11 offenses? And the answer is no. It does not per se create new ballot measure 11 offenses. Some of these arson ones may end up being ballot measure 11, but not all arsons are, and in fact most arsons are not. I have been prosecuting arsons in my county for about 7 years, and just yesterday I had the first defendant sent to prison on a Measure 11 arson sentence. So most arson fires do not end up being prosecuted as Measure 11. These could, but they do not per se come out as Measure 11. Instead, the bill targets extensive damage and fire sets with specific and unacceptable risk to firefighters, multiple set points, modifications made to enhance the spread or impair suppression efforts, and the use of incendiary devices. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Geiger. Bob, sit up here.
That's fine. I'll just move in a little bit. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also currently a firefighter here in Salem, and I'd like to just briefly echo some of the comments made by Chief Burr here. I, too, have been involved in several fires that have found out after the fact known to be caused by arson, and one of the things that I think I hope that you'll recognize is that as the fire service progresses, one of the things that needs to progress along with it is some of these changes in the statutes with respect to arson. And what I particularly like about this bill and what the firefighters like about this bill is Section 1D that specifically talks about intentionally damages or attempts to damage a structure that the person modified with the intent to impair fire suppression efforts, injure firefighters, or enhance the spread of the fire. And just if I could, I want to just give you a little bit different spin of it and put it into context what a firefighter has to go through. As you know or may not be aware of, fire, if it goes unchecked, can double in size every minute. So as soon as we get the alarm, obviously, even in a urban setting, we're talking anywhere from 3 to maybe 8 minutes before we arrive where a fire could potentially go unchecked. And within that time, the company officer that arrives first has to, one, determine the life safety of his crew, determine the life safety of the individuals that may be in the building, configure building construction, and a whole bunch of other things that he has to make split-second decisions on. And one of the things that I think that is important and why this bill is necessary is that with the proliferation of lightweight construction, any modifications that people make, and particularly in arson fires, truly puts not only individuals that may be trapped inside the fire at risk, it puts huge risk among the firefighters. And it's only, unfortunately, we try to always consider maybe the fire is arson. It's only after the fact, and I have personally experienced where there's been multiple sets and where you discover that you've been fighting a fire on the first floor and thinking that that's where the most of the smoke is, only to discover that there was multiple sets in the basement and discovered that just by sheer luck that you didn't have a collapse because the structure had already been burned out. And I think that even in short history, while this is not an example here in Oregon, we must also remember the Mary Pang fire that was an intentionally set fire, where now in today's light, and certainly with the events that are unfolding in Iraq, as we see some of the scientific technology, some of the chemicals and some of the accelerants that are out there available to the public can basically burn at degrees well over 2,000 degrees, 3,000, even 6,000 degrees. And I think this bill will help to achieve those people that are good at what they're doing, giving the tools to the prosecutors to go after these people that not only risk the lives of the citizens, but of the men and women that serve in the fire service. And we would strongly urge you to pass this bill. That is definitely good public policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Bob. Questions, committee? Representative Mack.
Yes, I just want to make an introductory remark because I do believe that the arson statute does need some reworking. And I applaud the efforts that are here, but I just have some questions on a couple of the phrases and a couple of the terms. And I'm coming from a point where I believe it should be our goal to clearly define our criminal statutes, not so much in the sense of a deterrent, but when you're in a trial situation, and I have done criminal trial work, what a criminal defense lawyer will look to is confusing phraseology in the statute, in the charging statute, because it's very, very difficult for a court to fashion a proper instruction to the jury on that point, thereby allowing defense counsel to argue, sometimes persuasively, reasonable doubt. Okay, that's where I'm coming from. I have trouble with the definition of property of another, in that it seems to start out that it means property that's not the property of the actor. And then the last clause says, even though the actor may have a legal or equitable interest in the property. That's confusing to me. Can someone help me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, can you direct me, is this in the bill?
Yeah, okay. Page 2,
okay.
Property of another. The top.
I have a definition, and maybe this will help Representative Ackerman, that comes out of the definitions for arson, criminal mischief, and related offenses starting at 164.305. That defines property of another means property in which anyone other than the actor has a legal or equitable interest that the actor has no right to defeat or impair, even though the actor may also have such an interest in the property. I don't know.
And
if
that's the same one.
Is that the exact definition?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's being repeated. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Counsel?
Yes, well, I looked at this too. What I think has happened is if you look at the language in bold 4 and you look below at the removed language in subsection 3, it's basically the same. I think what Legislative Counsel's Office did when they looked at it, it was not quite in alphabetical order. Right. Because protected is before is after property, and I think they moved it up. Well, the only change that I could find is it says may also have a legal or equitable interest in the property, and what it says below, even though the Ad Committee also has such an interest in the property. And I think what they did is they repeated have a legal or equitable interest rather than saying also have such an interest in the property, such an interest referring back to its antecedent or equitable interest in the property. I know that doesn't answer the question of what it means, but I think it is why you now see it in bold language. I believe it's more of an editorial change.
Yeah, I know it's an editorial change, but because the language does appear to be the same, but I still think as long as it's here and before us, it causes me a problem to know what you're talking about. If you mean property of another, that's fine, but that last clause says the actor also may have an legal or equitable interest in property, and that's confusing to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if I understand your question correctly, two things. One, first of all, it was not our intent to affect any substantive change to that definition. But to go more directly to your question, since you raised that, if I understand you correctly, I think what they are talking about is the situation where a person sets fire to their own property, though somebody else may have an equitable interest. I'll give you an example. I did just last summer prosecute a man for setting not one but two fires in his house. He set one. We charged him. He was out on release pending trial, and he set another one. The second one destroyed the entire house. His defense basically was, I was drinking, and only an idiot would destroy their own house. Well, I didn't argue a whole lot with that part, but he was able to be charged because there was, like most people, a mortgage on the house. And going back to, I hope I'm answering your question, the language that you're looking at that is quite a mouthful basically enabled me to say, in this case, the victim was the loan company because there was $120,000 that was owed on the house, and that that collateral of the house is no longer there. And does that answer your question, sir?
Well, I think it does, and I guess I'm a little bit hung up on the use of some property concepts here, rather than just saying, you know, if the property is torched or, you know, somebody intentionally sets fire to a building, and I don't really care. I mean, I do care whether it's occupied or not occupied, but I don't know that I need to have all these gradations in here of destruction. But I'm just sort of throwing this out to get some idea, some feel. I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you may.
Situation. And if I just read it, I'm under Section 1, and I'll then I want to go down to Section A sub C, where a person commits a crime of arson in the first degree if by starting a fire he intentionally damages any property and recklessly causes serious physical injury to a firefighter. Seems to me that that's going to be awfully hard to prove in many instances where a fire could be intentionally set and the actor may not know that it would cause serious physical injury to a firefighter. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be more appropriate here just to drop out the word recklessly and indicate that the crime is committed if the actor starts a fire, it intentionally damages property, and there is physical injury to a firefighter as a consequence. I'm just sort of throwing that out because it's going to be awfully hard in many instances to prove that reckless state of mind if the person says, well, I was starting a small fire outside my ex-girlfriend's window, and this was a joke, and I didn't know that, you know, the thing would explode, and firefighters would come, and firefighters would be injured. And then you'd lose your case. Anyway, I just throw that out for discussion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I was told that perhaps I could expect a question, something along those lines. I think your qualification to the question is, you know, that it's sort of outside what we're putting before everyone. I did not get advance notice of the question with sufficient time to look at whether or not I think the law would require a mental state, a legal mens rea, to attach to that particular conduct or not. So I don't know what the answer to that would be. It does seem to me that perhaps somebody thought that there would need to be a mens rea requirement to hold someone accountable for that. I don't know the answer to that. I do agree with you that it is a mouthful if you've ever looked at the definition or the jury instruction for recklessly. I think you could probably run a computer search on it, and it would probably rank the language as postgraduate. And that's certainly not the way we like to talk to our juries with such highfalutin language. But so I'm not quite sure whether or not deleting the word recklessly from that section would be a good thing or not.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Chair, members of the committee, picking up on that point, I think what may be the concern there of the original drafters is, and particularly with the changes, let's say that someone gets a permit to burn down their own building, and for some reason they don't know that there's a big windstorm coming up the valley, and it fire gets out of control, as they often do, and causes serious. And the firefighter comes out to fight a fire somewhere else and gets hurt. There would be, a question of whether, in fact, the person was reckless. Under the current statute, if you took it out, he may be guilty of arson one. I mean, that's what I think. That may be what they were trying to get at in the original draft of this.
And Mr. Chair, Counsel Taylor, now that you point that out, I would agree, and I think that that's probably why it would need to be included in there. With that, and using your example, they would not be guilty of arson one unless their conduct was seen by the average person of the community to present a substantial and unjustifiable risk, in this case, of serious physical injury to a firefighter. Number of circumstances where a person may be lawfully setting a fire. Fire is always a dangerous thing, but not under conditions where there's a substantial and unjustifiable risk.
The one place that it seemed to me where there was the possibility, as we talked about whether or not there'd be expansion from a cost standpoint in this bill, was the small sub B under Section 1, where we're making the change where it says the person violates 164.315, which is the Arson 2 statute, and the damages to the property exceed $50,000. Currently, under it's an arson 2 if the property, if the damage exceeds $750,000, and there isn't a damage threshold currently for property damage in arson 1. Am I right about that analysis?
Mr. Chair, you are correct so far.
So you know, fundamentally, I think the comments that you've made about and the other witnesses have made about the starting more than one fire, the using an incendiary device, the structural modifications, those pieces I think are pretty clear and I think appropriate. And I'm not saying this is inappropriate. I'm saying this is the one piece, if you think you're going to jack up the possibility of charges and we're going to increase the number of charges, it seems to me like this is the one that's going to be the one that picks it up. Because again, it's picking up a sort of a property damage threshold that currently doesn't exist in the statute. I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea. I do think that that's the thing that may drive any costs associated with the legislation. Rationale on the $50,000 threshold, gentlemen. What was the thought there?
Mr. Chair, the $50,000 threshold came in order to be consistent with other current sentencing guidelines. For property crimes, there are a number of subcategory rankings, and the uppermost of which is $50,000 or more. It goes in increments of $1,000, mm-hmm. $5,000, $10,000, and then $50,000. So in order to be consistent with existing law, the $50,000 was selected. Thank you.
Right. In arson 2, it's any building of another that is not protected property. Protected property is defined in the statute as property where you anticipate there's going to actually be somebody in it. Isn't that the best way to describe it? A home or an occupied building, but not, you know, an abandoned farm shed or something like that. Is that a fair distinction?
Mr. Chair, very, very close. Customarily occupied is going to be the key. So the expectations actually of the arsonist are irrelevant to the actual customarily occupied.
Right.
So there is at least a defense argument. I know if we charged a vacation home that was customarily not occupied for a long, you know, several months out of every year, there might be, you know, I'm sure that we would face a challenge, and sometimes we would lose on that issue.
But to the extent that to the extent under the change, if the vacation home's damage exceeded $50,000, this would allow you to charge it as an arson one.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. Thank you, sir.
Okay, is there any other questions, committee, for the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
You anticipated the question I was going to ask, and it would be helpful to me because I'm less familiar with the penalties for Class C felonies, which is what arson in the second degree is, as opposed to Class A felonies. What's the difference in presumptive sentence, assuming that there's not a Measure 11 element? So if it's under the regular sentencing guidelines, I just want to get a feel for how appropriate that seems in relation to the $50,000 threshold.
Okay. Thank you. Going to the sentencing Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. I'm sorry. I'm out of my element here.
Your answer is still right, even if you don't acknowledge me before you go to him. You're just fine.
Sir, there... Sentences in the state of Oregon depend on two things. They depend on the seriousness of the offense, which under felony sentencing guidelines, every offense is given a number for the grid, and then logically, the offender's criminal history. So those two things determine what the sentence would be. Now, on paper, for any C felony, in theory, a person could get up to 5 years in prison, and for an A felony, up to 20. But in reality, that number is controlled by sentencing guidelines. Right now, an arson 2 would be ranked anywhere from level 2 to level 6 on the sentencing guidelines. All of those for an offender with no criminal history or only property felony offenses on their criminal history would be presumptive probation. Now, it is possible to get the court to depart from that and impose some prison sentence, but the numbers are capped most typically well below the 5 years, and special findings must be made. It is a lot of extra work. The way I refer to it when I talk about this with people, I say, well, if I hit a triple axle toe loop, maybe I can get this sentence, but here's the presumptive sentence. For arson one, as it currently is, the presumptive—the sentencing guideline ranking is anywhere from a level 7 to a level 10. A level 10 is a ballot measure 11 offense. We have to prove the additional fact that the fire represented a threat of serious physical injury to other persons. So I'm having to put other persons, non-firefighters, there in the proximity of the fire and with no knowledge, those sorts of things. I think, if I read this correctly, a $50,000 arson one under this bill would come in at a level 9. The presumptive sentence would be 34 to 36 months in prison. The judge could depart down from that all the way to probation. The judge could depart upward to a maximum of 72 months.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does that help you out? Yes. Okay, Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, one thing, Ken Armstrong and I talked about this, and I know that the chair has brought this up as to the concern as to the physical. It may be something that I'm not sure the chair wants to move this right now or not, but we may want to be looking at having a higher threshold to keep the physical down, because in this day and time, any damage to any structure is probably going to be pretty damn close to being $50,000 or more. And if we, Mr. Lemon can probably give us the numbers, but I would expect we're going to find that it's going to be pretty high as to the fiscal impact. And so we may want to think about, even though traditionally for grand theft, $50,000 is the threshold, that you may actually want something higher to make certain it has the ability to get out of the building.
Yeah, and I was hoping that Phil, he was in the room earlier, and I was going to ask him to help us get a number. You can understand, gentlemen, given our current situation where
a little more hesitant than normal to expand and elevate when we can't afford to prosecute the stuff we've got mm-hmm. on the books already. That being said, I think that the committee generally agrees that the arson statutes have needed some fixing. And this bill goes the direction that I think would want to go. So I am going to ask Mr. Lemon to look at the numbers, and we try to not make him work every bill, but we're going to ask him to give us some specific numbers on this one. And I share a bit of the same concern. I can envision the situation of the kid out on the farm someplace who's starting a fire behind the farm shed that happens to have the, you know, $85,000 combine in it, and the shed burns down and the combine with it, and arguably he's now a C felon with the presumptive sentence, and whether it be charged that or not, obviously is going to be very fact specific on a case by case basis, but it does open up a whole range of potential claims, and I think Phil is going to have to try to give us some numbers on how that plays out.
And Mr. Chair, Ken Armstrong, I don't think we have any problem with that at all. Representative Przanski and I did talk about that yesterday. Something we've kind of kicked around a little bit. Our interest originally was just for consistency purposes. It seemed to make sense.
Sure.
The concern is very legitimate, and we're willing to be as flexible as needed.
Sure. Well, let's see what we find out. We're on a short timeline, as you know, and in our ability to deal with bills, but we'll make sure this one stays on the agenda while we get that information. Thank you very much,
John. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Susan Russell, do you want to come up?
Thank you.
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Lawyers, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm in here in opposition of House Bill 2802 as it is currently drafted, presenting some written testimony. What I've been hearing today is a serious concern, and I agree that the facts presented are a serious concern, that involve a small number of serious fires, these sort of arsons that have been set on purpose for financial gain, or that kind of scenario, where there's a, sort of a very skillful fire set, a modification of the structure, multiple fire set points have been described, and the use of an incendiary device. The problem with House Bill 2802 is that it goes far beyond that kind of a circumstance, that type of extreme fire setting. I think it's very important to bear in mind that when we're talking about arson and fire sets, that 57% of fires are set by juveniles, and a very large number are also set by people with mental illness. I've outlined in my written testimony what, interpreting, going through House Bill 2802, I've determined that there are five new arson crimes being added to the arson statute. Three of those are of extreme concern to the OCDLA, and I'd like to go through those one by one. I have some examples of just how expansive, in my opinion, the reforms proposed in House Bill 2802 are. The first new crime of arson, one that would be created, I've listed as recklessly placing another person in danger of physical injury or protected property of another in danger of damage by starting a fire or causing explosion. I've written this down number one in my written testimony. There's no requirement under House Bill 2802 that fire itself actually be set intentionally or knowingly. There's no requirement that the defendant intend to damage property. This lack of an intentional mental element contrasts with every other form of arson one, which requires at a minimum that the person intentionally damage property. One must intentionally damage property, for example, and recklessly cause serious physical injury to a firefighter or peace officer under current law. But under this proposed amendment, one need only recklessly place another person in danger of physical injury or protected property in danger of damage. No other Class A felony that I'm aware of can be committed purely through a mere reckless mental state. Manslaughter in the first degree has a reckless mental element. also requires additional elements, such as manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life. There is no requirement under what I've said, number one amendment, there's no requirement that a person actually be injured or that protected property of another be damaged. There's no requirement that the threat of damage or injury be imminent. There's no requirement that the defendant intended to cause harm to persons or property. The crime would include, and I've come up with some hypotheticals, the crime would include the following, because remember, there's no requirement of an intent to set the fire, an intent to damage property or injure. Setting a badly designed campfire, throwing a cigarette out a car window, burning leaves, yard, or house debris in a backyard, discarding a lit match after lighting a charcoal grill, lighting firecrackers, causing a fire exposure when working on one's car, leaving a stove burner on, forgetting to unplug an iron. Whenever a person or protector property of another is nearby and could be harmed by the resulting fire, the fire itself may be relatively small. So that's the first, as I would say, new arson one that is created by House Bill 2802. And for the reasons set forth, is of extreme concern and goes way beyond, I think, what the proponents have in mind. The second one, number two I've written down, is intentionally damaging or attempting to damage a structure by setting a fire or explosion where the person modified the structure with intent to impair fire suppression efforts, injure firefighters, or enhance the spread of the fire. I think that amendment is more in the design of what the proponents are proposing and the type of sort of serious, calculated arson for my financial gain that the proponents have spoken about in their testimony. The third new arson one crime that is would be created by House Bill 2802 would be defined as following: as intentionally damaging any property of another by starting a fire or causing an explosion, and the resulting damage exceeds $50,000. Our concern here is that the fire set itself may be relatively small, yet cause great damage, even though this was not intended. I think some of the proponents have talked about examples where somebody sort of consciously or purposely is burning a warehouse or a building that is not regularly occupied by persons. But it can also occur, this same crime as defined by House Bill 2802, when a kid sets a small fire in a garbage can or to our outdoor yard debris, and it spreads, and the damage is of a significant financial value. If protected property, meaning property which is a dwelling or regularly occupied by persons, is damaged or is in danger of being damaged, under current law, that is already arson one. Arson one also exists under current law when there is a danger of physical injury, and there is a fire set to a sort of a non-dwelling building. It's unclear from the language of House Bill 2802 whether the damage must be caused by the fire alone itself, or whether fire suppression efforts what's often causes a huge amount of damage in these kind of cases, the built-in sprinkler system, which does a huge amount of financial damage. So you can have a situation where fires are set as a prank. They're small, and the sprinkler system comes in and does tens of thousands of dollars of damages. Many arsons involve fires set by mentally ill defendants. I've listed a couple examples, actual case examples, in my testimony, one of which was an individual burning his blood in an attempt to commit suicide. Another was a defendant setting fire to his own belongings in order to eliminate all DNA traces so that the CIA could evacuate him. Both fires were tiny fires that did not spread beyond the defendant's own room. And they took place, both of these, in what would have been an arson one now, because they were buildings that are occupied by persons, sort of assisted living settings. But I give you those examples because they were relatively small fires that were done by people with a number of mental illness issues, but had huge damages because of the sprinkler systems coming on and did tens of thousands of dollars of damages. Causing damage to protected property in excess of $50,000 is currently an aggravating factor under the sentencing guidelines. It elevates an arson one from a Category 7 to Category 9. a Category 9, I think it's already been testified, as a presumptive prison sentence for someone with no criminal history, presumptive approximately 3 years prison. I also like to point out that under Arson 2, when the damage exceeds $50,000, that is also an aggravating factor that elevates an Arson 2, which is presumptively a level 2 when there's no other aggravating factors, to the highest level of aggravation for an Arson 2. It elevates it to a level 6. I think that if we're talking about concern about the damage when we're in dealing with a building that's not normally occupied by people, an alternative, and in our mind, a preferred reform would be to elevate the crime serious category for the Arson 2, for example, to a level 8, which would make it presumptive prison. The fourth new arson crime created by House Bill 2802 is the one I think of all of them is of the most concerned. I'd say the first and this fourth are the most concerned to us. The fourth is intentionally damaging or attempting to damage property of another by setting more than one fire. And then what we've heard testimony about is this idea of multiple fire sets in a very sort of complex, rigged, plan to destroy a premise, a structure. But there's no requirement under the House Bill 2802 that property be damaged, only that the defendant attempt to do so. Scorching constitutes property damage. There's no requirement of a risk to injury to others. This crime would include, because it can be done simply by setting more than one fire, two fires, with either attempting or damage or minimal damage. So, for example, setting fire to paper towels in more than one sink in a school bathroom, even though the fires self-extinguish and don't spread, would become an arson one. Setting more than one self-contained trash can on fire, again, that don't spread, would become arson one. Setting fire to any two items that belong to another person, two letters, two pictures, two books, two hair clips, anything, would become arson one. That conduct at present is misdemeanor conduct. It's reckless burning, a Class A misdemeanor. Attempt to do so is an attempted reckless burning, a Class B misdemeanor. Even arson two requires a minimum of $750 in damages when the damage occurs to something other than a building. And as I say, this bill would simply require any damage by setting more than one piece of property on fire. Teenagers frequently set multiple fires, and I think that this bill is going to encompass a huge amount of juvenile conduct that really is not of the level of harm that the proponents have described, not even close to that. And then finally, the fifth new crime that's created by House Bill 2802, which is more, again, along the lines, I think, that the proponents are proposing this bill, is intentionally damaging or attempting to damage property by starting a fire using an incendiary device, which is defined in the bill, and it is, again, a very sort of clever, specific fire-setting behavior. So those are the five new crimes that House Bill 2802 creates. It is very expansive. I think it goes far beyond what is intended. I do think that because we have such a diverse group of people that are participating in fire setting and such a huge amount of juvenile behavior, that this is going to really bring a lot of people into the criminal justice system and facing Class A felonies where before their conduct may have been a misdemeanor conduct. I anticipate it would be a huge fiscal impact because of that. And finally, I would point out that we're also taking the risk in this kind of behavior that some people would be pulled in under Measure 11, because Measure 11 doesn't actually require that there is serious physical injury, simply that there's a threat by the fire that takes place. For those reasons, we feel that House Bill 2802 is too widely drafted and goes far beyond and brings in a number of conducts that really are more appropriately charged as misdemeanors or as arson twos. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Questions, Council?
Chairman, members of the committee, Ms. Russell, in the DeFore case, one of the problems was, if I remember the facts correctly, as a young man and set fire to some newspapers, and then the apartment building burnt down. And the issue there was that the court did not find any value in the newspapers. I mean, they went through a whole analysis of what the recycle value was, and the district attorney was trying to argue the value was in the coupons, and they said no. As I said, it resulted in the apartment building burning down and some people being killed. One of the intents of this bill is to address that issue. What is your suggestion for addressing that issue?
Mr. Chair, counsel, I don't think that this bill addresses that issue for this reason, in that that decision was based on the definition of property, that property was defined under Oregon law as being an item of had some value. It had been argued at the trial level, my recollection of that case was, is that the papers, it had been argued by the defense counsel that the papers, a stack of Oregonians sitting outside on an apartment balcony, open apartment balcony, had no value. That was rejected by the trial court. It went up on appeal, and the trial court, the appellate court, determined that the papers had, in fact, did not have sufficient value to constitute property. So I don't think that this bill is addressing that issue, and I haven't heard the proponents actually even speak that that's something that they're attempting to address in that. So I don't think, because that is, that case was based exclusively on the definition of property, and not this $50,000 damage issue wasn't an issue. That was protected property in terms of being an apartment building. It was sort of the causation that was the problem in terms of that case.
Well, here's what I think we're going to do. We need to figure out, I think, whether or not this is going to jack the costs up pretty substantially. They say they don't think it will. If I read your testimony, we'll have to build a whole new prison just for the arson folks. So somewhere in between there, we're going to have to figure that out. So I'm going to ask Mr. Lemon to give us a fairly complete analysis of the bill. That'll give us some indication of how broad the language is, at least from the people who are going to have to apply it from a forecasting standpoint. And we can talk more. And I'd encourage you to sit down with the folks who presented before you today and talk a little bit about the concerns that you've raised and see if, because I'm not sure there's a complete agreement on either the intent or the operation of the bill as you've described it and they've described it. And I'd like to find out whether or not that's achievable through some discussion and modification of the testimony, or if it's just a complete difference of opinion that we're not going to be able to resolve.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank
you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2802. We're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2865. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bradley and Mr. French if they would come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm the first assistant to Mr. Schrunk. We're here on 2865 asking you to support the three areas in it. I might say this, is that we're here to save you money. This is going to save money, and also what it's going to do is it's also going to protect a lot of innocent people. And I'll explain that as I go through the sections. There are three sections. In fact, Mr. Harkle wrote here. I believe he's also testifying on behalf of the bill. But what I'd like to do is go through Section 2, Section 3, and Section 4 as far as what they do. What Section 2 does, I might say that how this bill got started is before, I believe, the legislature met. Mr. Harkleroad, Mr. Penn, Ross Shepard from the public defenders in Lane County, I believe Mr. Taylor, Mr. Prinz, Ms. Christian, and a number of other people got together with some ideas as how could we reduce costs in the system. And 2865 was the result of those meetings. Not to say that everybody agreed, but we discussed them. What Section 2 does is this. It says that the district attorney on Class C felonies and possession of controlled substances in Schedule 1, that the district attorney, using written guidelines, can, in cases, reduce those cases from felonies to misdemeanors. There's a practical reason why we have to do it. I think Representative Barker has known me probably longer than anybody else here when he was a police officer, and I come down here, and this is, when I thought about it, I thought this was an odd bill for me to come down to introduce and to sponsor. But in fact, it's a bill that I think the times require it. Currently, our office, we lost two trial deputies doing drugs. We're being told by our county commissioners that if our levy doesn't pass, we're going to lose two more deputies to prosecute drug offenses. And quite frankly, as far as the possession cases go in Multnomah County, without adequate staffing, we simply cannot any longer prosecute the cases at the felony level. We have sometimes the legislature passes laws. For instance, felony driving while suspended was a good example, where we simply did not have the staff to prosecute those cases. So what we're left to do is we have these C felonies that the legislature gives us that we're unable to prosecute as felonies, so we have to find an avenue how to prosecute them as misdemeanors. And what we've done in the past is we've reduced things from the substantive crime to the attempt crime. Example, felony driving while suspended, we used to charge those with attempted felony driving while suspended, when in fact is we had the completed act. That led to some problems in court where people pled not guilty and wanted to go to trial, and sometimes the judges say, well, this is a completed act, it's not an attempt, not guilty. By allowing the prosecution at the discretion of the prosecutor subject to standards to reduce some of these felonies from felonies to misdemeanors and then try them or plea them accordingly, I think it's reasonable. And the other thing we do is we actually label the crime for what it is. In other words, if we have an attempted felony, a felony driving while suspended, and we're not going to prosecute it as a felony, to be able to prosecute it as a driving while suspended actually tells us what the crime is. As I've said, the reason why when we met, the idea was to reduce costs to the system. This will reduce costs. It'll reduce indigent defense costs because they'll no longer get felony attorneys. They'll get misdemeanor attorneys. It will reduce our costs because we're not going to have to send these cases to the grand jury, but rather we can issue complaints against them. And again, with our reduced staff loads, especially, and I don't know that we're the only county that this has happened to, is we're just simply unable to prosecute some of the felonies any longer as felonies.
I don't know if Mr. Harkleroad has any...
One other thing is, I've talked to Steve Dole about this, and he just asked me to say this, is that he would support 2865, except he would ask for an amendment saying that the district attorney may elect to treat non-person felonies, Class C non-person felonies, as misdemeanors. And when I say non-person, I'm talking about under the sentencing guidelines. The other thing I would ask is this, is that the other amendment it may need would be an emergency clause. And the reason I say that is right now, I think most district attorneys in the state are under in a crisis as far as dealing with its cases. And it would be really nice if this committee and the legislature approves this, it would be nice to have something in effect by July so that we could do this and not have to wait around until, what is it, December or January? And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Harkleroad.
Mr. Harkleroad, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I support 2865, and so does the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The principal reason for that, I believe, is that it will save money and allow us to continue to prosecute cases in a time when there is not enough money in prosecution because of state and local budget cuts. In a perfect world, I wouldn't be in favor of doing this. It's not a perfect world, and I don't see it becoming perfect in the next biennium. So we need to do something that's better than the way it is. And this is better than the way it is. I didn't have a chance to speak to Mr. Bradley. I have one small little suggestion for a change in the statute on line 9, where it says the election must be made by the district attorney orally. It should say orally or in writing at the time of the first appearance. Then we can just put it on the charging document. make the decision earlier, put it on the charging document, and then it will say driving while suspended dash a misdemeanor, and everybody will know. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Mr. French?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Chuck French. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. One of the functions of my job is to oversee the grand jury proceedings in our office, and one of the things we've done, our office has lost 21 deputies in the last year and a half, as we've made an intensive, the last 3 years actually, an intensive effort to attempt to find ways to streamline and economize the system and try to save various agencies money. One of the things we focused on is the grand jury process. And when we came to examine that process, we understood, or began to understand, just how much money that process cost, not only to us, but to the police forces in our state. I met with Jim Ferraris, who's the commander of the Detective Division of the Portland Police Bureau, and Assistant Chief Andrew Kirkland. It became apparent to us that the Portland Police Bureau is spending approximately $750,000 each year to pay for overtime for police officers who testify at grand jury proceedings. In many instances, that overtime simply represents an officer testifying that he, in the chain of custody, he received a knife or a drug or something like that and put it in the crime lab. Police officer has to come in and testify for 30 seconds, and the police bureau, at least in Portland, pays him for 4 hours worth of overtime for that. It's a tremendous expense to the Portland Police Bureau, and so we start thinking about it on that sense. In another sense, for small police agencies like we have in Multnomah County, like the city of Fairview or city of Troutdale, and I think probably throughout the state of Oregon, many like this, they only have several officers on duty at a time, sometimes only two. To have someone drive into, Baker City, for instance, and testify means that whatever district they patrol is essentially without security for them to testify for 5 minutes in front of a grand jury. So we began to look at that, and we all understand, many of us who are familiar with the federal proceedings or federal criminal procedure, that hearsay testimony is admissible in federal grand juries, and we decided to determine whether that would be a feasible alternative here to allow police officers' testimony to come in under hearsay without a problem with the hearsay nature of it. We concluded that we wanted to check on that, and so what we've done in subsection 7 here is to allow a police officer of a particular bureau to testify about what another officer observed and wrote in an official police report in the grand jury. So we aren't just allowed, and this would only apply to police officers. It would not apply to statements made by civilian witnesses. It would only apply to the sworn or to the testimony of a sworn officer as he related it in an official police report. It's actually much more restrictive than the federal government law that allows hearsay in federal grand juries. And I guess our point is that if the federal government feels this is an appropriate way to handle things, we feel it's an appropriate way to handle things. Also, we're restricting it even more than the federal government is restricting it. We believe that throughout the state of Oregon, the Oregon State Police, for instance, send troopers up to testify in Multnomah County, probably, if they're on duty, it's probably 3 or 4 hours that they're unable to provide protection to the citizens that they otherwise would serve. They're spending many, many thousands of dollars, and police bureaus around this state are spending many, many millions of dollars each year for testimony, which oftentimes simply amounts to just perfunctory testimony about the transmission of one piece of evidence from one officer to another, or evidence that they would otherwise write in their police report. So we strongly suggest that you would consider this and consider it appropriately for passage because we do believe it's a measure that that would save a lot of money and would also allow us to maintain a certain level of protection for the community cost effectively. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could address Section 4, because
yes.
As far as this committee goes, I think this is as important as anything. And I think it's a great problem. It's a great problem in our county, and it's going to be, my guess is, as the years go by, it's going to be a great problem everywhere. I have in front of me 148 cases from the middle of August of last year until the end of December of last year, and then I think 41 other cases that have come in this year of people who have been charged or convicted that in 95% of the cases we know they're innocent. They're just out and out innocent. And what it is we allow people to use any name they want or any name they're charged with when they come in. And as a result, we don't always proceed on people with their right names. And as a result, what happens is people get convicted and they never even came to court. And this is this list I'm holding, about 200 cases since August, I think it's August 12th of last year, of people who have come to our attention who were either arrested and convicted of cases that it wasn't them. Now, when Representative Barker was a police officer, he saw this probably where it was somebody's brother or sister. But today, the identification has gotten so good as far as getting false identification that we have talked to the police, and they have said that even a seasoned police officer today, the identification, the forged ones, are getting so good that even seasoned police officers can't tell the difference. We're doing a case tracking system in our office. Yesterday, I talked to the people we're putting together. They said it's not unusual to have four or five names on an individual who's in the court system at this present time. And when I say the different names, I don't mean John Bradley and John C. Bradley. I mean John Doe, John Adams, and John somebody else. What this bill says is this. When someone comes into court, they have to give us the right name. And it says that we can't use that acknowledgement against that person for the underlying offense. So in other words, if the person came in charged with forgery, and they have to acknowledge their true name. We can't use that against the person in a forgery charge. This says that we have to try to use the person's legal name, and it states what a legal name is. It states that if we discover that the name is wrong, it gives us an avenue to go back before the court and change it. And also what it does, it gives victims, especially where someone's been victimized, it gives the victim the right to go back and have the name changed. This is a mess, and Mr. French has worked on this for some time. This is not going to be the solution. It's just part of the solution. And like I say, it's something we see every day. The other day, Mr. French and I went to the front desk, and it was some guy who'd gone out to get a job at the airport. They did his record check. He had 3 felony convictions and had been sent to the penitentiary. This guy had never been convicted. He had never been sent to the penitentiary. But his employer, the possible employer, believed that. And we get this on job applications. We get it on loans. We see it all the time, and it's getting greater and greater. And with the cuts in our office, we have been able to help people less and less. But I've got to tell you, it's one of the most serious problems we have. And these are people who are truly innocent. And we've got to use people's correct names. And if we don't, innocent people are getting convicted.
Let me address that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Another one of the things that I do in my job is to, as Mr. Bradley has said, handle this issue of misidentification or false identification. And I can tell you, just as a matter of figures, that every year we catch approximately 1,500 people who have used incorrect names. Now, we catch those people because they've been arrested and they've been taken to a booking center where they're fingerprinted, and we actually find out that those are the people who are that those people have given us false names. As I'm sure Representative Barker would know, we don't catch a lot of them, those people who we've given citations to and released out on the street. We have no real way of knowing, other than there are a whole lot more cases than the 1,500 that we did catch, where people are using false names and we don't catch them. And the ones we don't catch are the ones that create tremendous problems for someone who is out on the street and all of a sudden finds that his tax rebate check has been taken by the state government because he hasn't paid a restitution figure that someone else used when he went into court and said, yes, I'll accept that under someone else's name, and of course didn't pay it. Where a job, where someone loses his job or won't get a job because he appears to have a criminal record that he doesn't have, we need to grapple with this problem. It's only going to get worse. This is step number one, I think, in dealing with this problem, and there should be other steps to follow, but this is an important one to deal with because we can deal with it within the context of the court system this way to some extent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes, question. And I do want to remind the committee we're short on time and we've still got a few more bills to do. So,
okay. Well, I'm just curious whether this defines true name as birth certificate or some other name changed by the court. Does everyone have a birth certificate? What about non-citizens? What do we do in those cases? And I'm not even sure if do citizens all have birth certificates. I know everyone should, but...
Chair Williams, Representative
Fairley. It's a definitional issue. I support what you're doing, but it's a definitional. It's an awfully narrow definition of true name.
Most. Let me do this. Most of the people we see two categories of people, and you're right. People who are born out of the country, and every time they're arrested, they use a different name. And whether or not we can actually find what their true name is, I don't know. But we deal with an awful lot of people who were born in the United States who do, in fact, have birth certificates. And so we may not, by this bill, you know, solve everything, but it'll solve a lot.
No, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The reason I think that is a concern, though, is to say if we don't have the true name, then they're ineligible for any form of release. So we've got to have a definition of true name that works, whether they have the right documentation or not. It seems to me we do anyway, or we're overbroad. That's all. Again, I support what this is all about. I think
right.
But it does raise an issue.
Further questions? We're going to need, I mean, obviously you've all suggested some amendments to this bill, so I'm going to have you work with Mr. Taylor on tightening up the things that you've mentioned on preparing amendments, and we'll bring the bill back. But not before Representative Brzezinski asks your question.
I think just some points. If we're looking at going forward on this true name, I didn't see anything in here as to what the level of crime it's going to be. That would need to be established.
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, I'm not setting it as a crime. I mean, I left the crime out of this because I didn't want it to have a financial impact. I just want to try it out where we're trying to get people's real names without, you know, I'd love to make it a crime. But I think it would be, you know, if we can get people's real names for a while. And
we'd have to build that prison next to the arson.
That's what
you're telling me.
I didn't put many teeth in it.
Well, I mean, a lot of courts already, John, aren't they? I mean, the ones I'm in front of, they will ask the person, is that your name or is that your true name? And, I mean, I'm not sure if we're not going to criminalize this, if we're really going to be gaining much by putting it in the statute.
Well, Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, I support that idea, but I just don't know that this is the right time to do it. I mean, I would just like to at least take the symbolic step of trying to get someone's true name, and also where we know that somebody that's just not their true name have a mechanism to change that.
Okay. Good, thank you. Two more witnesses not testifying together, but I'm going to call them up together just to expedite the effort on the part of the committee. Susan Russell and Ann Christian again. And Ann, I'll go ahead and let you go first since you've marked the box of testifying for the bill, and then we'll let Susan. You must have drawn the short straw today at OCDLA, Susan, to be in front of us. Go ahead, Ann.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Christian, and today I'm representing and believe the Public Defense Services Commission in support of Section 2. I'm not here on behalf of the Judicial Department, although that does not indicate that they oppose it. they take no policy position on this bill. Section 2, indeed, is the result of some work on behalf of individuals trying to deal with reduced funding within the public safety sector. And as a result, on the defense side of it, as far as administering defense, at least for the short term, I am in favor of this provision. It's critical that to the extent district attorneys can make this decision to treat what is otherwise a Class C felony or a Class B possession of controlled substance case as a Class A misdemeanor, it's critical that they make that decision at the time of the first appearance of the defendant in order to affect savings with regard to things like juror costs and also indigent defense costs. Because I'm behind, I thought I would just give you a quick estimate that we have as far as the potential for indigent defense savings. And, of course, we cannot estimate with any certainty the extent to which district attorneys will take advantage of this discretion if this bill passes. But if they were to treat 50% of the cases covered by this bill as Class A misdemeanors, it would be a cost avoidance of about $3.6 million, not just in the original Class C felony, for example, but in felony probation violations on down the road. And then quickly to Section 7, I have to back up and say I am now speaking with a concern with regard to the Judicial Department. Section 7 provides that one of these individuals, if it comes, this is in regard to the true name issue, if it comes to the district attorney's or the court's attention that an individual has been released from custody and indeed is not the case is not proceeding under that defendant's true name, I'm on page 4, line 27, provision is that once the court finds out about this, the magistrate who released the person shall cause the defendant to be brought before the magistrate. I just envision, and since there will be amendments, I'll work with the proponents for something that maybe makes it clear that that's not an affirmative duty on the court's part to identify those individuals and to issue warrants. I think the intent would be that district attorneys would bring those matters to the court's attention. And otherwise, I have nothing to add other than I have one little suggestion, since there will be amendments, to provide that if a district attorney or I as a citizen were to find out that I have a felony conviction, and indeed I really don't because it wasn't me, that there be a provision for amending judgments as well as simply the accusatory instrument, which is the current language in the bill.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Ann.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association in opposition to parts of House Bill 2865, and I'll try to be very brief in my comments. We do not object. In fact, we support Section 2. Our concerns are with the two other provisions, starting quickly with Section 5. It's Section 4, 5, and 7. 4, 5, 6, and 7 all deal with requiring a defendant to state his or her true name at their arraignment. We do not object to Section 5, which is the provision that will allow someone whose name has been wrongly used by another individual to come to court and have a procedure or a proceeding in which they can clear up that problem and have the wrong name no longer, their name no longer wrongly used in a criminal prosecution. We support Section 5. That is not a problem. What is a problem are the provisions that would require a defendant to state his or her true name. In our opinion, that would violate sort of time-honored rights of a defendant to remain silent and against self-incrimination. There is a provision here that would provide that the defendant stating his or her true name could not, that fact could not be used against the defendant in the underlying charge, but there may be many other charges that could arise. Let's say that a defendant is required to state his or her true name, and it won't be able to be used in that prosecution, but if the defendant states his or her true name and it turns out in 20 other prior occasions he's used a false name, that defendant would be exposed to 20 furnishing false information prosecutions. So there are a number of situations in which this provision would violate a defendant's right against self-incrimination. In fugitive issues, for example, identity is a critical issue. So we object strongly to that provision, and we also object to the provision that the defendant insists on his or her right to remain silent and against self-incrimination, that they will not be released, or if they are released, that they will be arrested and put back into custody. I don't think that that's the right way to go about this, and I think it's really violating defendants' constitutional rights and is really going to open this whole bill, if it were moved on, into a number of constitutional challenges. Finally, briefly, we have concerns and object to section 3.7, which would allow the hearsay testimony of officers. I understand the concerns when we're talking about chain of custody issues where the officer's testimony may be very procedural and minimal. But this provision is not limited to those circumstances. And in our opinion, the grand jury proceedings are secret, they are not recorded, and that it is important to maintain the standard that hearsay not be allowed and that the evidence code apply in those proceedings. And so we do object to this proposed reform that would allow an officer to testify as to another officer's hearsay statements.
Representative Brzezinski.
Susan, would the OCDLA be an objection to that section if it was limited to for chain of custody, as Mr. French used as his example?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, I don't think we would have a problem with that.
Okay.
And Susan, I'm not going to, I guess, take the time now, because the bill is going to have some amendments anyway, but I guess I would need to get a better understanding for the not using your true name statements that you made there. I guess if a person isn't going to give their true name because they don't want us to know that they've got a whole bunch of potential outstanding warrants or other instances of having not given their true name that they could be prosecuted for, not under the underlying charge, I'm not sure that I want to let them out. I mean, I sort of makes the point, it seems to me. I guess I'd have to really think more about, and I don't want to do it here, but I noticed some other sort of concerned stares by committee members as to the constitutional issues that you were trying to raise there, and to the extent you think that it raises them, I guess I'd encourage you to help us understand them better when we've got more time, because I'm not sure that we're buying it right now, I guess is what I'd say. It just seems very frustrating to me that we can't require somebody who has been arrested to give their true name, and I'm not sure that giving their true name violates their right to self-incrimination. I mean, who you are ought not to be the thing that self-incriminates you unless you're going to be incriminated by the fact that you are who you are. And I guess I have a problem with that part of it being sort of a violation of their right to remain silent. But again, I'm mm-hmm. willing to be schooled in the Constitution on that issue when we've got more time.
That would make two of us, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Krummel. All right. We're going to close the public hearing now on that bill. And the Pratts have been sitting there so patient, and so I'm going to leapfrog to give them an opportunity to testify before things start to get a little hectic. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2885 and ask the Pratts to come forward, if you want to both come up.
Mr. Chairman,
you're certainly welcome to join them, Representative Barker, at the witness table. Do you want to lead off, Representative Barker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I brought this bill which would revoke the privileges of a person, driving privileges of a person, I should say, for the record, Jeff Barker, representative from House District 28. I introduced this bill, brought this bill forward, that would revoke driving privileges after the third conviction of driving under the influence. At the present time, it's four convictions. And to keep timely here, just to keep it really brief, The only objections I've heard about this so far at town halls and so on, meeting with citizens in my district, is they can't imagine why we're waiting for the third time, why it isn't done sooner. And I'll just stop there so we can proceed. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. and Mrs. Pratt, whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll also try and be brief. I'm Ann Pratt, for the record. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and Parents of Murdered Children, and I am in full support of House Bill 2885. Repeat drunk driving offenders are among the most stubborn, persistent, and deadly threats on our roads. In 2001, there were 41.3% of all traffic fatalities were due to the intoxicated driver. And 8.2 were drug-related, and the drug-related are on the rise. But still, alcohol seems to be the number one, or is the number one, contributing factor. There were over 25,000 DUI arrests in 2001, 22,000 convictions. Many drug and alcohol offenders have drug and alcohol problems, meaning addiction. They tend to be more aggressive, more hostile to other drivers, and don't view drunk driving as a serious offense. They also have enablers, family and friends, who enable them and defend them when they are caught. And their behavior is very tough to affect. There is no quick fix. I believe that we need to be as equally as persistent and stubborn. We need to improve and reinforce the existing DUI laws in our state. A very disturbing fact that I learned was 70% of all fatally injured children were the passengers of drunk drivers. Other states have also seen the need to strengthen DUI laws. Maine has had a 0.05 BAC tolerance level for quite some time. And actually, West Virginia and Georgia are proposing life in prison if you kill under the influence, if you have a 0.16 or over BAC level. I think Oregon needs to step forward as well. Three DUIs is actually a fourth DUI if the offender has chosen diversion on the first arrest. My husband and I are volunteers for the Lane County Victim Impact Panel. We've heard lots of comments, and some of our observations are that most do take it seriously. Some just wanted to go home. Some had been there more than once, but I'll never forget the elderly offender in the back row who turned to the man next to him as the victim was telling her story and said, "I've heard better stories in a bar." Some just don't take it seriously, and sometimes we even smell alcohol. Not everyone shows up also. More than 1 million people are arrested annually in our nation. And it's estimated that they drive between 200 and 2,000 times before getting caught. And a third of the intoxicated drivers are repeat offenders. I had a figure of 470 on the third conviction in our state for DUI for 2001, but it was corrected after I wrote my statement to 666. I've also enclosed some monetary cost sheets with my statement. One of them is impaired driving in Oregon. Another one is a national cost sheet. Please also consider these facts. The monetary cost in Oregon for each fatal alcohol-related injury is $53,000. And for each alcohol-related fatality is $1.1 million. Why should we pass House Bill 8555? Because it could be deadly not to. And we all know it takes one event to change the history. And a lifetime revocation for someone convicted of three misdemeanor DUIs could possibly mean someone's life. And maybe it would prevent another family from serving a lifetime sentence without their loved one. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Mr. Pratt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt. I reside in Lane County. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. There are two points that I would like to add to what has already been said. Number one, this country is far too lenient in its attitudes and laws toward drunk driving. European countries, on average, find 0.05 as the acceptable blood alcohol content. consequently, they have a much lower percent of crashes that are alcohol-related. In support of that, they have a zero tolerance for refusal of the breathalyzer test. Many crashes that have alcohol involved are caused by the hardcore drunk driver. Most people who get stopped for DUI have driven drunk many times, as has previously been stated, before they are caught. A third conviction for DUI therefore equates to more incidences of driving under the influence than I would like to think about. By the time the drunk driver gets a third conviction, that person has established habits and may have already killed or injured someone in a crash. I must say that I agree with Representative Barker. This bill does not go far enough, in my opinion, but it is a step in the right direction. This bill will send a clear signal that we are serious about reducing drinking and driving. In order to change the attitudes about drinking and driving, we must make our laws tougher and continue with educational programs. Second-time offenders need to receive a strong and clear warning about the consequences of their third conviction after we pass this House bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. Mr. Harkleroad, do you want to testify on this bill?
Thank you, Chair Williams. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Harkleroad, Lane County District Attorney, and representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I just wanted to tell you that the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports this bill, and I thought you ought to know that.
Thank you, Mr. Harkleroad. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I just have a question. If there's a diversion program, does that count as part of the three, or is that excluded?
That would not be a conviction. It would not count as part of the three.
So by the time you're getting
before.
Yeah, by the time you're really getting to three, it's really four for most people who, if people have gone through a diversion.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Jensen.
Is there any way to make that a conviction if there's a second conviction?
Well, that's a tougher row to hoe, Representative.
I understand it is. I didn't ask that.
Well, if we can, believe it or not, we can do anything with the law, Representative.
Oh, okay.
Almost anything, okay. When we don't bump up against the Constitution. But so your answer is, yeah, you could do it. And I'd encourage you and Representative Barker to work together on a bill that we might see later, if that's what you want to do.
Well, it just strikes me, Mr. Chair, that this is we're terribly lax with this particular behavior,
and I don't disagree with you. And it comes down to a series of issues about what do you want to do with those people. And as most of you know, if by the time you get to a third conviction, it's clear that somebody's got a problem, and what we ought to do is probably stick them in jail for a couple of years. But we know how much that costs, don't we, Mr. Harkleroad?
Yes, we do.
And right now we don't have the money to do that, do we, Mr. Lemon?
I'm not the budget person.
Yeah, right. I mean, we just don't. But I mean, it's an excellent point. But I think that this bill does move us somewhere down the road a little further than we are now. Council.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, at one time we did look at a bill about a third time DUI a year in jail, and I think we're talking about 2,000 or 3,000 offenders. So we're talking a lot.
Yeah. We'll put it next to the arson. Well, that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to decide that you were going to deal with those offenses and not others.
Yeah, I understand.
Anything else, Mr. Harkworth?
Nothing.
We're always glad
on
to have you
bill.
With us. Yeah. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2885. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2885. Representative Barker? You want to move your bill?
Yes, I do.
Sir. Okay.
Sorry, I was
get the number.
In the middle. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move this to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2885 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on this motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Just to note, there were 9 members of this committee either as sponsors or co-sponsors of this bill, so I'd say the dash was kind of loaded on this.
You just pays to do your homework. Okay, hearing nothing, Nancy.
Okay, Ackerman.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Crummell.
Aye. Aye.
McPherson.
Aye, double voted.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Bill moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker would like to carry it.
Indeed, sir.
And we'll show Representative Anderson and Representative McPherson as excused. While I've still got a quorum, colleagues, I want to move quickly into a work session on House Bill 2092. Colleagues, House Bill 2092 would essentially eliminate the right or remove the right to court-appointed counsel in post-conviction relief proceedings. We've had this bill up for hearing before. We've gotten a lot of information. We know that the bill is opposed by a number of people who believe that there will be cost shifts and no savings in this bill. We've got some preliminary fiscal information that might suggest that that's accurate. In my conversations with the folks in the Ways and Means Committee, I think the only way that we really get this issue defined on the fiscal is to send the bill down there and let them have the discussion in the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means. I have indicated that if there is a fiscal shift that does not actually save the state of Oregon, the courts, or the indigent defense system any money, if it's not going to save us any money, it doesn't make sense to obviously do it, because the system as it is works relatively well. Despite the fact that it's got those costs associated with it. If, on the other hand, there is a savings to be achieved here, I would be supportive in making in supporting the bill, but I think they're going to be better suited to make that determination and to get the fiscal. So my recommendation to the committee is that we move the bill without recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee so they can do the work they need to do on analyzing the fiscals with the various parties, and that would be the chair's motion. Is there discussion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I still have reservations about this bill. I will, however, support the chair in moving it to Ways and Means and reserve my reservations for any subsequent action that the bill might entail.
Thank you, Representative. And that's about the nature that I'm sending it down as well, and I appreciate you putting that on the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm doing exactly the same.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Anything else? Me too?
Always, huh?
Yeah, okay.
Me too.
All right, so the motion is then that we move House Bill 2092 to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Any further discussion? Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
McPherson? Pulaski?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2092 moves to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Okay, last bill up is House Bill 2877. I'll open a public hearing. Ask John Bradley, Chuck French, and Susan Russell to come up, for the three people who signed up. Oh, you didn't sign up, Doug, but we're glad you're here. So, Susan, if you can hold up, we'll give the seat to Mr. Harkleroad.
Mr. Chair.
I guess I should just assume these days that you're such a regular now in our committee, Doug, that we'll just put you on every bill, and then you can wave us off if you don't want to testify.
Chair Williams, I apologize for not signing up today. I was down in Ways and Means on the DA's budget today.
How'd that go?
I'm glad to be here.
Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I actually have to leave for a hearing to give testimony, but I did want to put on the record, I support the bill as it's written, but I also want to put on the record that I don't believe that this bill, in this case, limits a prosecutor at this time to actually make offers to a defendant prior to or at the time of arraignment. And I want to make certain the record clearly reflects that, because if it doesn't, that's exactly what my office does in two different jurisdictions, that we directly make offers at the time of arraignment in the sense of trying to move cases through the system. And I understand that for the more established larger offices that have early disposition programs, that they may need this clarification.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Why don't we go ahead and start with Mr. Bradley? Or do you want
to... Mr. French, the only thing I want to offer, Chair Williams, is that I'd like to see an emergency clause in this, only because this is something that will save money, and again, it's probably something that will, it's better that we do it sooner than later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, members of the committee, this bill, as Mr. Bradley has indicated, has its genesis in an attempt to streamline our program, our criminal process, and also to save money. In this case, I think the savings will come through indigent defense. And let me tell you where we started with this. In 1997, we attempted in Multnomah County to institute a program where, on misdemeanor cases, defendants were given pretrial offers by the prosecutor prior to being appointed attorneys. And this met with a certain amount of resistance from the court system itself and I think from some defense attorneys who felt perhaps prosecutors were overstepping their bounds in doing that without counsel. We pointed out there was no law that prevented that us from doing that, and I think as many attorneys who and attorneys in this committee here would understand that many times negotiations occur without counsel on the other side, just so long as those negotiations are controlled by ethical considerations of the Oregon State Bar, they're proper. Nonetheless, judges in the county sort of required us to say, show us a law that says you can do this, and this is why we want this law, to show judges that we can do this without any problem. And the real problem that arises is in Multnomah County, what happened is we developed a process by which attorneys were appointed automatically on misdemeanor cases to hear our pre-arraignment offers and consult with those defendants in court. And my guess is in the last 5 or 6 years that we've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on indigent defense funds in Multnomah County because the court system essentially has insisted that we have attorneys available to and have set out contracts for them to do that. We've had attorneys available for them to talk to prior to arraignment or right after arraignment. We want something in the legislation here that will tell the court that, well, we can provide an offer, and if the defendant wants to take that before he incurs liability for paying his court-appointed attorney costs, which can be $400 or $500 for a relatively minor case, that he has the option to do that, and that we can set up a process by which that can happen. Not only will it save money in indigent defense funds, but it will allow us to process the case that day, rather than setting it over several times and then down the line after incurring more defense attorney fees and more court appearances in which judges have to appear, defense attorneys have to appear, paperwork has to be made up for all those cases that we ultimately get the same resolution. So that's why we feel it's necessary, at least in our county, so that we can wave something around and say, here's the law you said you wanted us to see, it's right here, and we want to proceed with our work.
Okay. Mr. Harkworth.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports this bill. Some of you may know that Lane County has a wide range of alternative programs, quick disposition programs, and we currently run a deferral of charges program, and the public defender participates in that, being in the courtroom and advising clients about that. Our program is like dead in the water today because there's a whole bunch of cases that for which the pursuant to the Supreme Court Justice's Chief Justice's order are not being represented, and this bill would allow us to continue that process and give those defendants that opportunity if they so choose to take it without us giving them obviously legal advice. And so it would help us immediately if this bill were law tomorrow. In addition, there are times, and I'm, by the way, I'm hopeful that the public defender will be back in the courtroom doing these cases and recognize the value of this program to their clients. But I have no guarantees of that July 1 that that's going to occur. It makes it very hard for us without having this little statute to speak to the defendants and say this is something that is available to you if you so choose to do it without giving them legal advice. The same problem that was just described in Multnomah County would happen in Lane County and has happened in Lane County. And so if you want the quick disposition programs that you passed Senate Bill 133 last session to work, we need this.
Okay, thank you. Questions? All right, thank you, gentlemen. Susan?
And Dave.
Okay. And Dave Bedanke.
Sure. Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I've provided written testimony, and I'll try to be very brief in my comments. We are here in opposition to House Bill 2877, and we are concerned that this is sort of a veiled attempt to eliminate the right to counsel in these early disposition programs. It changes the current statutory provision so that there need no longer be a process to ensure legal representation and consultation. At present, legal counsel is appointed whenever a defendant is required to enter a guilty plea. I think it's a matter of course and in this state. I've listed in my written testimony a number of different things that a defendant will no longer be able to do. They will not be entitled to an attorney. They will have no investigator or other type of individual assigned to the case to be able to look into it. When a defendant is determining whether an early disposition program is in his or her benefits, whether to accept a plea offer, it's critical that the defendant be aware as to the merits of his or her case, and there will be no one with any expertise able to do that. There will be no one that can assess defenses. I've written a number of those down. There'll be no one to determine whether it's double jeopardy issues or statute of limitations, whether the case fails to state a claim. There's no one to assess whether the search, the seizure, the arrests were legal or constitutional. They're very extremely complicated areas of law. There may be a number of viable defenses, of self-defense, a defense of others. A number of times these cases involve domestic assault cases. There are collateral consequences in terms of the right to bear arms and in terms of criminal history for future prosecutions. There may be defenses of lack of intent or diminished capacity, mere presence of the crime of a scene, mistaken identity. There will no longer be any investigation into interviewing defense witnesses, state witnesses, visiting the crime scene, or checking state witnesses' criminal records or prior false accusations. Defendants will be forced to decide whether to enter a plea in a vacuum with no legal assessment of their case. And as I said previously, we oppose the bill for that very reason, and we believe that a defendant should have a right to adequate representation to be advised as the merits of the offer extended.
David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also appearing in opposition to House Bill 2877. Mr. Chair, there is currently great controversy in this state about the procedures that have been put into effect in trial courts as a result of the lack of funding for indigent defense. And it is far from clear what the ultimate outcome of that situation will be. But I think that this bill highlights, and Ms. Russell's testimony highlights, the dangers of trying to dispose of criminal cases without defense counsel being involved in those situations. It would be ironic indeed if it becomes commonplace in many non-person criminal cases for the only attorney that a defendant ever sees in a case to be the district attorney. That we believe would be a very sad state of affairs. It's absolutely true that in many cases these kinds of early disposition programs may be the best option for everyone concerned. But we believe it is clear under the Oregon Constitution that the right to counsel attaches very early on in the process. And we strongly believe that the current procedures being carried out in trial courts across the state violate the Oregon Constitution as well as Oregon law. And as I said, that issue is currently being litigated. I believe it would be a grave mistake to jeopardize additional dispositions in criminal cases by allowing even more cases to be disposed of without counsel having had a chance to consult with a defendant, that is, counsel on behalf of the defendant being able to consult with that defendant. The process, we believe, has worked very smoothly under this statute currently, where defense attorneys have been available to consult with clients in an expeditious fashion and resolve these cases very quickly. And that's the sum of my testimony, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity.
Are there questions? Representative Barker.
Let me understand. So this is the defendant comes to his arrest, the DA would go up to him and say, here's the deal. I'll offer you this. If the person says, I want to talk to an attorney, they'd get one, would they not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I assume so, except that under the current circumstances, if it is one of the offenses for which counsel is not being appointed, then it would have the effect of postponing any action on that case, including arraignment for the defendant, at least until the next biennium. It's the position of the ACLU and also, I believe, many public defenders that these cases that are currently in limbo will eventually have to be dismissed with prejudice. And that those prosecutions may never be able to proceed. And one of the issues that we're very concerned about is that defendants, you know, let's say this bill was in effect today. We're concerned that defendants would be put in a situation where they would be told by a district attorney, look, I can offer you a deal today, but if you don't take that deal, then your case is going to be in limbo for months to come, and this is going to be hanging over your head. And that in that situation, most defendants, not being aware of their rights, not being aware that there's a possibility the criminal charge might have to be dismissed later, would go ahead and accept the deal, even though they might be innocent, even though they might have a defense to that charge. Because they haven't had a chance, because they don't want it to be hanging over them. That kind of coercive situation, we believe, is going to call into question these dispositions in the future.
So, David, you're suggesting that the program has, if we were to do this, you think it would be constitutionally flawed?
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions? I mean, it seems to me what they're doing here, David, is they're making a determination to waive the right to counsel. So long as the district attorney provides no legal advice, doesn't give them legal advice, just simply lays out what their options are, but doesn't advise them of their rights, their choice is to just say, I don't want to do it, at which point, you know, they get counsel appointed, at least under the system, is it supposed to work when we're not in the midst of a budget crisis? I guess I'm struggling to figure out how, you know, sort of, and if their waiver wasn't a knowing waiver, wasn't, you know, didn't meet all the waiver terminology that's required for a waiver of your right to counsel at the time they accepted this, then it could be challenged. But assuming that it was an appropriate waiver of their right to counsel, how does that create a constitutional problem?
Mr. Chair, with due respect, I think the issue is whether it is a knowing waiver when the district attorney is prohibited from, I mean, is the district attorney going to tell the defendant, look, it may be that this prosecution, that I could never pursue this prosecution against you because of the current circumstances that we're all in. I don't think a DA is going to say that. I think a DA is going to say merely, you have a right to counsel, but you also have a right to waive counsel. And if you waive counsel, I can offer you this special deal today and today only. And I think the question at a later date in a post-conviction proceeding or something else is going to be, was that a valid waiver of counsel? And we don't think it will be.
And that is going to be something that these district attorneys who are typically pretty smart about the law are going to analyze, and they're not going to want a whole bunch of cases reversing on them if they think that the waiver is inadequate. I'm going to assume that they're going to be extremely careful that they don't get all these cases overturned by doing something that isn't going to qualify as a knowing waiver as the law requires. Susan?
Mr. Chair, we have the same concerns that this is sort of a coercive waiver of the right to counsel. I would let the committee know that, and I don't think there's going to be disagreements from the proponents, but at present, I think judges are very reluctant to accept waivers of counsel. They're very concerned about being involved in that because there really is a question almost in every criminal case with the consequences of whether it's a knowing waiver. And I mean, I've been in court so many times in criminal cases where defendants have wanted to proceed, have been standing up and down saying they're going to represent themselves, they want to take the deal, and want to waive counsel. And they're often told to go away and come back because the courts understand how complex these types of cases are, and that for someone to be able to knowingly waive that right is a complex matter in and of itself. And the courts don't want to be put in a situation where, you know, the case is going to be reversed or they've not, you know, they've accepted a waiver under circumstances that are dubious. So I do think there is a serious concern here.
We're out of time. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask Virginia Vanderbilt in my legislative counsel's office to issue me an opinion as to whether or not she thinks this bill has constitutional problems, and particularly address the waiver requirements, and let the district attorneys have an opportunity to weigh in as to what the statement or the waiver requirements ought to be, and if we have to write something in the statute that identifies the things that they have to disclose to the defendant in order to meet those waiver requirements can be put in the statute, then we'll look at it at that point. But I guess I struggle. We almost make it impossible for someone to do what they want to do, which is to potentially waive their right to counsel to get a deal that they may in fact be wanting to take with full knowledge of it. And I think that, you know, obviously if a DA abuses that power, post-conviction relief is going to turn that case right back around on top of them if in fact the waiver was inappropriate. But to the extent it's not, I'm not sure that we necessarily want to be a roadblock to a mechanism that can get a whole bunch of people through a system that does what it needs to do in delivering the right level of justice at much less cost and not violating anybody's constitutional rights in the process. Jerry, you'll be the last comment because we're going to
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, what kind of cases would the DAs use this under?
Well, the program is identified in Chapter 135, Jerry, and it's defined as non-person offenses, which means Class A or B felonies, which are non-person, and a person felony or person Class A misdemeanors, as those terms are defined in the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think that's not completely correct.
I got that wrong. I'm reading right out
it's
of the
actually, I think
here.
A and B, I think that the first thing is that A and B felonies cannot be part of an early disposition. All misdemeanors and all Class C felonies, if they're non-person.
I've read it backwards. I read you what can't be as opposed to what can be. So A and B felonies are out, and person felonies and Class A misdemeanors that are person crimes are not allowed to be in.
Right.
So it's all the non-person stuff.
You can't offer the death penalty without counsel.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Okay. All right. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to adjourn the committee.
Yeah.
Ask Virginia for
that would be for representative.
Oh, I know. I think he's probably lying. I want to catch him in the lot.